Hello and welcome to Talking Shit About, a monthly podcast where I, Elizabeth Weberman, interview someone about something they love, something they hate, something they've been through, or something they just know a lot about, and hopefully by the end we've all learned something. I'm joined for the intro with my cat Ampersand, who is chewing on my nose and rubbing against the mic, so apologies for the background noise. This interview is another great one for you guys. And I recorded it months ago, but it's very topical for me right now because in May I'll be starting my master's degree in social work, so it's kind of relevant there. That also means I will have less time to work on the podcast, which means April, for now, we'll have the last microsode for the time being. So we'll just go back to our monthly episodes, just trying to preemptively, you know, take care of my sanity. Again, speaking of sanity, this is an episode about what it's like to work at a state hospital, specifically in psychiatric care. So, Justin, thank you so much for coming on. Before we jump in, let me do my quick spiel. If you are a fan of the show, please subscribe on your favorite podcasting platforms, give the show a rating, follow me on social media, and what was the other one? Oh, two others. You can join my Patreon for $2 a month, and or you can visit my merch shop and get some cool, I almost said swag, but I'm pretty sure nobody except like us millennials and Gen X says swag anymore, so, you know, get your merch. Okay, let's go ahead and talk some shit.
I was like, what the fuck does that mean? I have friends that are firefighters, and I know that they use soap.
And she was screaming at me over soup.
Fuck this, I am not ever talking to a Scientologist again. These people are all insane.
I'm putting my bricks in the dumpsters, motherfuckers! Do you see me, bitches? I'm throwing my bricks! And he's just like chucking bricks.
I am here today with Justin, and we're going to talk about mental health, hospitals, and all sorts of jazz. Before we dive in, Justin, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm great. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I will let you kind of introduce yourself, if there's anything you want people to know about you, and kind of how you got into the role that you're in now.
Yeah, so I am an MSW. I graduated just recently, just a couple years ago. With my MSW, working on getting my LCSW. I work at a state psychiatric hospital where we treat, which they, you know, they kind of say the worst of the worst, which I don't necessarily approve of that kind of label for some of the people that we treat. But essentially, the community resources are unable to handle their psychiatric condition, and they are sent by court order to the state hospital where I work. How I got in the field is just kind of a series of events. I worked within a children's group home for a long time, and I just felt like I did a really good job there. And I was really encouraged to pursue a degree in social work. That way I could become a therapist, and just working towards being a child therapist. And I'm doing all my, you know, footwork to get to there through the state hospital right now.
So you mentioned that people refer to patients there as like the worst of the worst. Could you maybe kind of like elaborate on maybe like, you know, not necessarily like specific behaviors or anything, but like why people have that perception?
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of the patients patients we see are floridly psychotic. So full on disconnect from reality, you know, a lot of individuals may be experiencing like the government is after them, or they think they need to do something in order to stop the world from ending, you know, and they're just floridly psychotic, a lot of aggression and paranoia, different things like that. Some people just can't take care of themselves. So they may be experiencing catatonia where they just are existing, and we treat that. And yeah, they end up at the hospital once they have been exhausted all resources available in the community throughout the entire state. There's a process where they go and see a judge, they are appointed a lawyer, the judge actually has to sign off on it, and then they are admitted into the hospital that way.
And is this kind of the setting, well, you mentioned you wanted to do, is it child therapy?
Yeah, just eventually work. My heart is with kids. However that may look, I'm not sure yet. I have a few years to worry about it, but yeah, that's where my heart is at with working with children.
And is the state hospital just adults?
Correct. Yeah, the 18 and over. Yep.
Do you have like a typical day in your role right now, or is it kind of up in the air? Depends what's going on.
Yeah, it's kind of up in the air, but at the same time, there's some base stuff that I have to do. I am allowed to do individual therapy, even though I don't have an LCSW. As long as I'm working towards that, I'm able to do individual therapy, which I'll get assigned a caseload, and I do like individual treatment plans, and I also do their social assessment as well as their discharges. So it's a lot, and on my caseload right now, I only have four patients, which is pretty light at the moment. But that is expected to go up. And treatment plans include like nursing and then any medications that they may be taking, also discharge planning, and really encourage patients to get as involved as they can in their treatment because we want, they have that right to self-determination. And so we want them to be as involved as they can. And typically, the mornings are pretty structured where, I get there at about 7:30 and I have about an hour and a half to kind of do any collateral information that I may need on each patient and work on maybe with families or the community in order to set up appointments for when they discharge. And then at 9 o'clock, we have a morning meeting where we discuss each patient individually and discuss on kind of what's going on and how we're going to move forward with each patient. That's every day, Monday through Friday. And then after that, it's just kind of we plan our schedule. There's some necessary things that have to take place. So we have to meet with a patient 24 hours, 72 hours, 10 days, and 30 days after they've been admitted. It's required. And we meet them as the treatment team. So that would be the doctors, the therapists, the care planners, everybody meets with the patient to kind of check in and see where we can help out and what may need to be done from there. Individual therapy can be any time that I want, really, so I can schedule that how I need to. And then they have groups also where they can go to. Some of it's, music appreciation or could be art, mindfulness. Their groups run from like 9 to 2 o'clock in the afternoon, or something like that. So, a lot.
And then I kind of forgot to ask this question earlier, but could you kind of paint a picture of what the environment looks like the physical aspects of the building and like infrastructure? And then actually, yeah, I guess that's more of what I'm thinking of.
Yeah. So, the hospital is kind of separated in different area. So there's even like a rec center where there's a full basketball court and they have a stage. Sometimes they'll even bring in bands to play for the patients because some of them may be sentenced there for 6 years.
But
We
then
also have a geriatric unit where we have like the older patients with dementia where they're at. So they have their own separate unit. But the main hospital has four different wings. There's Alpha, Bravo, Charlie's like a rotunda area, so it's like in the middle, and then they have Delta and Echo. Each one houses patients, so it's like a wing. So if you were to think about it, it would go like two wings. If you were to look at a square, it out of the corners would be the wings, and so just each corner has Alpha, Bravo, Delta and Echo. I work on the intake unit. So, we get all the patients that are coming from the community. There's a rec center. There's also like a canteen out there. Each patient has their own, or the hospital has its own post office. So if
oh, wow.
I can even get a post office box out there for myself if I wanted to. It's an actual post office where there's a federal worker that works in that post office. So they're not hired by the state. They are a federal employee working for the United States Postal Service. We also have a forensic unit that's down the road about 5 or 6 miles where patients can be sentenced there on the criminal side, a criminal commitment. But I've never worked out there. I will only work on the civil side where it's a civil commitment, and they only get sentenced there for up to 90 days. Can be more. Most of the time, it's less. And yeah, the unit themselves are pretty. I hate to really describe it this way, but it can be depressing at times. Everything's kind of really like the chairs are really heavy. So they're filled with like sand and water or something, so they can't be picked up and thrown. The windows are reinforced, so they're not like actual windows, if I can, if that paints a good enough picture, so they can't be broken too easily. If they were to go out in the yard's fenced off. I mean, there's no barbed wire or anything like that, or razor wire, but it certainly doesn't give a sense of freedom. And for a good reason, because most people are sentenced there against their will, so escape is, top on their mind. It's like, how do I get out of here? And that's mostly when you deal with patients. Most of the time, they just want to get out. They're angry, and for a good reason. It makes sense. But it ebbs and flows. Lately, it's been pretty rough with a lot of aggressive patients that are assaulting staff and, lashing out to at other patients. But for the most part, it's usually pretty relaxed, and most of the time the staff do a really good job of de-escalating and preventing and being proactive of any kind of disruption on the units.
Thank you. That was a beautiful picture. Well, beautiful as in, like, I was sitting here kind of as you were describing things, picturing my stint in an Oregon hospital. I was like, oh yeah, like I can see that. I can see that. So
Yeah, it's kind of depressing, but there is therapy that does happen there. There are therapeutic inner value in the state hospital, at least in my opinion. I think if you ask some of the patients, they'd probably disagree, but I've seen a lot of recovery there.
yeah, for sure. I think one of the things that sticks out the most in my mind when I was, and I was hospitalized voluntarily, was our music therapy. It was like an impromptu thing where the therapist was like, you guys want to jam? And we played Go Your Own Way by Fleetwood Mac. And now every time I hear that song, I have like really strong emotions. So yeah, that stuff can, like, it doesn't necessarily seem that big, but it can be pretty therapeutic.
Yeah, when you say strong emotions, is it a positive emotion that you feel because you experienced it in the hospital? So that could either go one either way, it could either be bad or good.
Yeah, that's excellent follow-up question. Yeah, so when we were, and I barely know the words to the song, but when we were all sitting there, these people, not all of us were like buddies in the hospital, but we were sitting there, and it was one of the most times I felt the most connected to other people. Us all
Awesome.
just sitting there playing on our maracas and box drums and stuff. And one of the patients had to get up and leave the room while we were singing because he started crying because I think he was feeling a similar way and was just so overwhelmed. So, I mean, right now I've got goosebumps thinking about it. Elizabeth here, popping in with some science. Research suggests that singing in groups can forge social bonds and do so quickly, and it is especially effective in bonding in large groups. It also is suspected to have a bunch of health benefits, so maybe that's why I enjoy singing along in the shower and in my car so much. Who knows? But anyways, sing with other people. It's good for you. But yeah, it was just a really powerful moment of connection in a space where, I mean, I'm glad I went to the hospital, but there were definitely like aspects of it that felt constrictive, and not always the most therapeutic, or at least I felt not necessarily what I needed.
Right.
But that moment was powerful, that connection with other people.
That's good. I'm really glad to hear that because there's always that negative perception of a lot of mental health institutions. I think a lot of the public, a lot of stigma surrounding that. Oh, they're just crazy, and they're walking around. you know, talking to themselves or rocking back and forth in a chair, which is in some cases that's the truth, but they do a lot of people do recover and are no longer experiencing what they're going through and have a full recovery.
I'm curious how your perception of like hospitals and the mental health care field was before you started this work versus now.
Yeah, so there's a lot to this one, and it's really, this is such a hard subject because can never figure out an answer. And I've had discussions at work as to what can we do better, you know, and how can we make, if we are all sitting around a table and we're just like, we have an infinite amount of money, infinite amount of resources, we have the perfect workforce, what would it look like if in an ideal world to treat mental health? And it's so complicated. There's just not a right, there's just not an answer for it. You know, we can't sit there and say, how do we get across this river, right? We build a bridge and this is how you build it. You know, you engineer it this way. And this is the most sturdy way of building this bridge as we know now with current knowledge. You know, there might be a better way, but currently we have the best way. But with, you know, the care system here, there's just never really a cut and dry answer to that. And how it's changed over the last couple of years, I think I have a really good perspective, at least where I work, only because I worked there previously about 2 years ago, and then I left for a little bit and came back. So I was able to see these huge changes, leaps and bounds, but I also see these big gaps as well. So for instance, the hospital that I work at right now, it feels pretty integrated. You know, each wing may have like 20, 25 patients, and there's four therapists for those 28 patients, you know, and there's maybe three or four care planners. They also have two psychiatrists on there working full time as well for each wing. So that tells you that there's quite a bit of help there. Where I see some gaps is within the community. A lot of funding has been cut, and now trying to get people out is more difficult, and keeping them out is even more difficult because the resources are just not there or not available to them that they need. So sometimes, as sad as it is, they have to go into a homeless shelter. And, you know, homeless shelters aren't maybe the most safe or the best place for them, but since so much funding has been cut, that's the only option, you know. And there used to be some great programs in certain communities that have been dropped, that are not there anymore. And it just sets these people up for failure to return. And the only safe spot for them is at the state hospital, which is not always safe. You know, it's not always the best place just because of the nature of the patients coming in there are so acute that they're a danger to themselves and other people. So it's really hard. You know, when I worked there a couple years ago, there was like one therapist for the entire institution, you know, and that's 120 Wow. patients or so. And he had to go around and try and do therapy. And it was mind boggling to me that this was okay. Now seeing that there's just four therapists on one unit is such a great step in the right direction. I feel good about the direction that the state hospital's heading. I can't say that for the community, though, because it seems like the community is starting to lack more and more resources, you know, through like state Medicaid and different things like that. They're no longer covering they're not covering as much of the needs of the patient. So they may, you know, they may pay $100 an hour for this certain program, but now it's only 80, or they're not going to pay cover it anymore at all. And it's really sad.
Are there any challenges that you face specifically in your role?
You know, I think for me, some of the challenges would be the involuntary commitment, because a lot of patients just don't want to be there and they just don't want to engage in therapy. And, you know, it's really difficult. You're just kind of waiting around sometimes for them to come around to the idea of talking to you. And then also discharges are so difficult because, you know, some patients just come in without any funding or anything, and you're you're sitting here scrambling trying to apply for these programs that'll help them. They're fine. They're ready to discharge, but you're worried of discharging them because there's nothing for them to go to. They can't afford their medication. They can't afford to see a therapist, or they can't afford to get their primary care stuff figured out. And we have to sit there and just kind of hold them and wait until we can get this funding. And then sometimes we have to just say, here's your appointment. You got to figure it out. And it sucks. It's a horrible feeling, but there's all our options have been exhausted. And by law, we have to discharge them. We cannot keep them against their will. It is against the law. Even if they're going back to a really bad situation, and that's what the situation they want to go in, we have to let them go in that situation. And there's always this thing in the back of your mind where it's like, okay, I wonder how long it's going to be until I see them again. And it's an awful feeling. It's awful.
What are some supports that you would like to see? I know that's kind of a broad question, but what would your ideal post oh, there goes my words. Post discharge process look like?
Yeah, ideally, family, if they have support from family, those are the best situations anybody can be in. It seems like there's a lot more recovery in when they have a solid support system with family, or they're known in the community and they have a lot of people kind of rallying behind them to do the right thing or do the best that they can. Seems to be the best scenario. A lot of patients that we deal with do not have that. They don't have anybody. They've burnt their bridges with everybody in the family. And so there's just nobody for them to go to. And those are the difficult discharges. But if we could fix that somehow, there's like the PAC teams who are out on the street and are on the field out there, picking patients up and making sure they're making it to their appointments, making sure that they're filling out the applications for all the social supports that they can get, and somebody there to, be kind of like a friend or a mentor to them. And the PAC services is in my opinion, probably one of the best things that has ever been developed. And I don't know the history on it. I learned, I should know all that, but the it was developed by some guy, and he just basically thought that this was something that would be great in the community, and it is. It's been, and it's slowly taking off more and more here in our state, and it's been a good thing. Also more of the funding aspect of it, A lot of people leave the hospital without the proper funding and the support that they need in order to thrive. And they just end up continuing in the system, just in and out, in and out, in and out. I've seen patients in the state hospital as many as 38 times, which is, that shouldn't happen. And if we want to really get into it, I hate bringing in politics, but because this is such a hot button subject, but universal health care to me is such a cut and dry thing that it seems like common sense, and that's really hard for people to hear that. They in their mind they think we're giving people too much, but it's just it seems like common sense that that's just something we should do just because that's the best for everybody. I mean, that's for me too. I reap the benefits of universal health care. I can go to the hospital, and get treated for nothing. I mean, it makes sense. It's not just poor people getting more. Everybody gets the same. So I've never been able to wrap my head around kind of the arguments against universal health care, but I think having that would be the ideal. I mean, no question. And housing. There's no reason why we can't provide every single person somewhere to live in this country. There's no reason. And I think even if it's not the most ideal home to go to, it's just a tiny home that might be as big as, like two bedrooms that has like a sink and a bathroom in there somehow. And just giving people that would prevent a lot of this turnover. And I'm almost certain of it.
Yeah, you can't see, but I've been nodding this whole time.
I'm sure. I know there's a few people out there that are like, yeah, I get it. And then I know there's a few people out there that just cannot stand hearing people might get something that they didn't some in some way deserve. I don't know. I still cannot wrap my head around it, but
Yeah,
that's the
and there's
country we
even
live in right now.
like, yeah, financial, like people have done the like calculations to see like this is how much it would cost to house everyone. This is how much it costs to transport them in ambulances and have them in the hospital and or jail, and it's always more cost effective to do those like preventative protective measures.
Right. And people don't consider how much they're paying in premiums to insurance companies and how much of a deductible they have to pay when they go in and see the doctor or the dentist or anybody. What you're paying each month in premiums is probably would cover a huge chunk of that healthcare for everybody, including yourself.
Another kind of divisive aspect to mental health is medication. So this is like a pro medication podcast. I'm on medication, but also emphasizing that that's not like the only pathway, not necessarily for everyone, but I believe it should be an option for everyone. And you mentioned when we were talking before we recorded, wanting to bring up the stigma around medication. So I just kind of wanted to give you the floor to talk about that.
Thank you for that. Because I was, before I started working for the state hospital, I was one of these kind of guys that was like, you just need to exercise and get the good sleep and eat the right food. And that is a huge component of it. It really is a huge piece, like making sure you got the proper nutrition, sleep hygiene. I cannot express that enough, is making sure you're getting enough sleep, because that is probably one of the most, like, when people end up in the hospital, one of the first signs is that they're not sleeping properly. That's when it first kind of starts taking off. So there's a lot of things that we can stress on that are natural, that can be preventative and protective, right? But there are just some things that you can't cure that way. And I didn't necessarily believe that before I started working at the state hospital. I thought, if you just worked hard enough and, took care of yourself well enough, you could avoid all of that. It's just simply not true. If you want to talk about miracles, I've seen medication work miracles. They are miraculous in recovery for a lot of people. And for example, lithium with people who are experiencing that may have bipolar disorder, where they have those really high ups and literally low lows. And that, as a mood stabilizer, it cannot is just works so well. And there's nothing wrong with being on medication. There is nothing wrong with that, because you can function and thrive and maintain your medication. It's just like any other problem you may have. If you have some kind of thyroid problem, you take medicine for that. Nobody looks at you like, oh my gosh, your thyroid's messed up. It's just like, oh, you have a medical condition. If you have cancer and you're taking chemotherapy and you're sick and you're throwing up and your hair's falling out, people don't judge you for that. They actually empathize and try and help you in any way that they can. It seems like mental health is the only discipline where people are looked down upon for taking medicine. And it should not be that way. It's awful, because as far as you know, them taking their if they you didn't know they were taking medicine, you wouldn't know. There's other telltale signs with physical ailments that somebody is suffering. But with for whatever reason, with the mental health field, taking medicine is considered this bad thing. And it stop people don't want to take their medicine because they're ashamed of it. And some people don't, and they end up back in the hospital all because of that shame of, oh, I'm schizophrenic or I'm bipolar. And it's scary for people, but it's not the reality. You can live and be just fine with it.
And then I know some folks stop taking their medications is because of side effects.
a lot of people, like I'm specifically thinking of antipsychotics, kind of feel like zombies a little bit, which I totally understand. I'm pretty lucky and my meds just make me really sleepy. Like I'm just sleepy all the time. But considering the alternative of like continuous racing thoughts, like you mentioned, thinking the government's after me, like I'll take being sleepy over that for sure.
I'm actually really glad you brought that up, because that's something that I kind of, that needs to be addressed as well. And it's, you know, it's one of those things that you have to discuss with your doctor about, here's what the medications will help you with, and here's the consequent or the side effects that you're going to experience. And you have to decide whether or not that's worth it or not. And that is a difficult piece on that. That's another one of those answers that is a personal choice. And it's like you said, for you, it's like the alternative is far worse. And for some people, they enjoy their condition sometimes. Sometimes it works in their benefit. It really does, but it only works until it doesn't. And so, yeah, that piece is hard, you know, but I think once, you know, you get healthy and you're on medications, there are natural ways of mitigating some of those side effects. Sometimes that's with more medication that has their own side effects. And we don't want to just keep pilling everybody, you know, just keep giving them pills to this side effect. You're itching. Okay, we'll give you anti-itch. Well, because of the anti-itch, you have dry mouth, you know, or something like that. And you just continue down. Yeah, I don't really know what the answer is for that, you know, but just part of that, you got to decide between you and your doctor if it's worth trying to try and the alternative and not take it and try another way. And it might work. Some people live with schizophrenia and they experience their hallucinations and they just know their hallucinations and they're able to kind of overlook that. And there are some people that are like that, and some people that need to be heavily medicated in order to function or have any kind of quality of life or well-being.
So I had a therapist, and when I started antipsychotics, I was like, hey, I'm feeling a lot better. I'm starting to kind of hear music randomly. And I was like, should I be worried? And she was like, is it bothering you? Is it impeding your daily life? And I was like, no, not at all. It's just like, sometimes I think I hear a song, but there's not a song. And she was like, if you're okay living with that, then that's okay. And so I think part of it is like knowing or trying to decide what symptoms are debilitating enough to warrant medication or treatment or anything. Do you have kind of any, I'm starting to ramble. Do you have any thoughts on where I'm going with this?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great, great point, because something I didn't touch on. Sometimes we end up with patients that are, it was a term coined by one of my coworkers, pleasantly psychotic. And they'll come into the institution because people were scared, not so much that they were a harm to themselves or anybody else, or that they weren't taking care of themselves. Quite frankly, they were doing just fine. It's just that they might have been going outside and, you know, been like going to the store to go grocery shopping, and they might have been talking to somebody about God coming down and talking to them, and it freaked people out. And so they end up calling the police because they're scared, you know, or something like that. And they end up, you know, in the hospital against their will. And so they're angry, and then they start acting out in the hospital. And then because they're there, they get sentenced to the state hospital. And then by the time they make it to the state hospital and someone's actually listening to them, and we're like, well, okay, we don't know why you're here, because it sounds like you had your house, you had your car, you're doing just fine. And they're just living life. They're just different. They just live their life in differently. In a different world sometimes, and they're not a harm to themselves or anybody else. So I'm not sure if that answered your question. I think I got a little distracted on that, because
no, that was perfect. Okay. Kind of jumping all over the place here. And if you don't have like necessarily information on this, that's totally fine. But I was wondering if you could kind of walk us through like what the process is for like a patient from when you know, they have either been like dictated to go to the hospital up until like discharge. I know it's probably gonna look different for everybody, but I'm curious if you could provide some insight on what the process sort of looks like.
Yeah, you're right. And you're right when you say it's the process is different for everybody. But typically there is a, you know, there's some outliers where there's just nowhere to for them to go and they're just not clearing up, so they'll stay there a lot longer. And there's some people that get there and then we discharge them in like 3 or 4 days. You know, it just but there is a baseline of how that works that is pretty typical for most people. One is usually they have some kind of interaction with law enforcement, or if somebody is calling the police on them, and they'll have an interaction with local law enforcement. They either end up going to jail or they end up going to the hospital because they're angry, they're not making any sense, they're tangential, they're experiencing hallucinations. And once they're either in the jail or the hospital, then they get evaluated by a doctor or a therapist, and they will be deemed unfit to be in the hospital or jail. They'll say that they are a threat to themselves, and we do not have the resources to care for this person. And so then they'll file something with the courts. The court will take the case. The patient will be appointed an attorney. It'll go in front of a judge. The attorneys, everybody will either agree or disagree whether they should go to the hospital or not. If they all agree, the judge signs off on it, and then that order gets sent to the state hospital. The state hospital receives that order, says, "Okay, on this day, we may be able to accept them. There will be a bed ready." And then they get transported to the hospital. There's an intake where we inventory all their stuff. They get put on the unit, and that day is when you meet the treatment team. So we usually know by like a day or two before they show up. We get all their information, including collateral information, and then we kind of see who this patient is. And then we're like, "Oh, okay, this is bad. They've been really aggressive. They've assaulted the police. They're really assaultive." We take note of that, and then we go and meet with them, and then we make our own idea of who this person is. Most of the time, it doesn't match who we have on paper, a lot of time. And then we start just kind of trying to figure out how we can help this person. Immediately, they get prescribed meds. 99.9% of the patients get prescribed some kind of medication right off the bat. They are floridly psychotic. There's no amount of therapy, no amount of exercise, no amount of food, or no amount of proper nutrition that's going to help this person at this moment. So right now, our goal immediately is to stabilize. And once we start stable, they start getting stable, which is usually a week or two, maybe 3 weeks. Once they start getting stable, then we really start looking at discharge. And for me, discharge begins the day that they arrive. I'm already looking at places that they can go, where have they been, who they know, all that stuff. But when they have an active part in their discharge is once they start stabilizing. And then we just start having those conversations. What kind of funding do you have? Well, where do you have family that is willing to? That would want you to be with them. And then the treatment team together kind of determines, all right, they're ready to go. Now, that can end in two ways. One, it could be they just go back to jail because they committed a crime that was, or they've committed a series of crime that they're not going to drop the charges. So they'll either return to jail or the charges get dropped and then they return to the community. And we try and set them up as best as we can because we never want to see them back. We don't want to see them back. We want to see them healthy and happy. Then, you know, there's supposed to be follow-up and stuff like that. But typically, once they leave the hospital, it is in my belief that they are set up pretty well as long as they continue their discharge planning and take their health very seriously, that there's no reason why they should return, in my mind.
Yeah, I when I was getting ready to be discharged from the hospital, I was talking to the psychiatrist and I was like, yeah, I've started ordering stuff for a go bag for my next time that I'm here. And her eyes got kind of wide and she was like, the idea is that you don't have to come back, but you know, good planning.
Yeah. Well, some people do like it in the hospital. Some people do like being there, you know,
yeah.
and sometimes they get out in the community and they just can't do it. They just can't cope. They can't deal with life, and they know how to act in order to get to the hospital, and they will manipulate the system in order to get to the hospital where they can feel safe and try again, you know, give it another shot with maybe better community resources this time. So sometimes that revolving door is simply because they know where to go that's safe.
Yeah. There's hot meals, structure, you're indoors, you've got a bed. And I think, like you were saying earlier, having those supports for people who, like, you know, our universal healthcare dreams and stuff, having those supports for people when they get out would probably help with the returning.
No doubt in my mind. If there was just enough support out there, I mean, yeah, you're always going to have those ones that are always going to, that just simply can't take to the programs. But for the most part, I think it would cut it in half, at least in half.
I'd love to hear some of the like rewarding parts of your work, or if there were any moments that you have had that you're like, yeah, I'm in the right field. This feels good.
Yeah. You know, the appreciation. Sometimes there are patients out there that have been felt so hopeless and felt like nobody's ever cared. And then they meet me or somebody else and they actually feel like someone's listening to them. And some of the gratitude that I've heard from some patients is so heartwarming. You know, it's like, wow, this is the part of the job that why I do this is because I'm actually making a difference in someone's life. You know, sometimes that's few and far, but there are other days where it just feels so good that you're like, yep, I did my job today, you know, and I don't want to, I would hate for somebody to ever go in this job just for that. You know, I'd hope somebody would go into this job to help for just for the sake of helping other people, but it sure does feel good when you get those kind of accolades or you get that recognition of, hey, I see that you're trying and I appreciate it because nobody ever really seemed like they cared that much. That's the most rewarding. Or you get a phone call, you know, a month down the road and they're like, hey, I just want to let you know I'm doing really well. And that is because of you. And I always kind of retort like, no, you did the work, man. I just told you how to do the work. You did it. Like, that's not on me. And I try to not take credit from patients that are saying, hey, thank you for saving my life. I'm like, no, I didn't save your life. You saved your life. I just gave you the tools and you chose to use those tools. But I appreciate it because I don't want them thinking that they have to have somebody else, that they did it on their own, because they really did. That's the truth.
And that is like the big part of recovery, is that willingness or desire to make that change for yourself. Because you can be surrounded by an amazing team of people who want to do or help you in whatever way that looks like. But if you're not ready to make that change, then they can't, you know, quote unquote, fix what's going on.
Yeah, they always try and tell us that, you know, don't work harder than they're willing to work. And I kind of believe that in a lot of ways. But at the same time, you know, you do need to go far and beyond for some people sometimes. And that little extra effort goes a long ways with people. But there's a lot of truth to that, because if somebody simply is like, yeah, you know what, I'm going to get off my medications when I leave. And I'm probably going to smoke meth, which I've heard that a couple times, where it's just like, yeah, I just want to go back. I just want to get out so I can go back and smoke meth. Well, you're going to set them up with what they need when they get out. But you're just like kind of detached from it at that point. You know, it's like, yeah, I'll do what I need to kind of cover my ass, so to speak. And I'll try and help you out, but they make it clear that they don't want it.
So I would love to hear how you leave work at work, if you're able to leave work at work, and sort of any ways that you practice self-care or just take care of your own mental health in this field?
Yeah, you know, that is always an ongoing area of growth for me because I do recognize the importance of you can't help other people unless you help yourself first. You got to put yourself number one. I believe that. It sounds selfish, but it is, but that's literally how you have to be. You have to make sure you are healthy before you can help other people. And as far as self-care goes, I try to follow the same routine that I preach, the eat the right food, get the exercise, get the rest that you need, and find, a hobby or some leisure activities. I fall short on that all the time. I do take my diet pretty seriously, but it's so hard because, nothing beats for me a Big Mac at McDonald's. Like I just gives
Yes.
me
Oh my
so
gosh.
much, so much. It gives me so much. But I know that in 20 minutes after I've devoured this double cheeseburger, I'm gonna regret it, because I'm gonna feel like crap. But in the moment, but it's fleeting, and that's the problem. And I try to pay a lot of attention to my diet and exercise, but it's just hard because there are days you're just tired, and you're like, you think the best thing for you right now is just to rest. So there's a lot of lounging, unfortunately for me, and leaving work at work. It takes practice because when you're off. Sometimes I'm thinking about patients, and I and one thing I need to do is just remove my email from my phone, my work email from my phone, because just today I got an email from family, kind of just telling me everything that was going on in their kid's life, leading up to him getting hospitalized, and I'm sitting there starting to write the email back. Well, it's Saturday, it's my day off. Like I don't. Nothing's going to change if I wait until Monday. The only thing that'll do is, one, it causes a little bit more stress, so to speak, on me, and it might give them a little bit of a sense of security that their son is being taken care of. But no, not much more than if when I respond on Monday morning. So I kind of fail at this, and I think if you talk to anybody that might be in my position would probably say the same thing, is that they just don't practice self-care in a way that they should. And it's always an ongoing thing that everybody probably practices. I can't speak for everybody, but from what I've seen from coworkers and stuff, their heart is in it and their heart doesn't really leave it, unfortunately.
So I have a couple wrap-up questions, but before I get to them, I just wanted to open the floor, if there was anything that we missed or that came to mind as we were talking that you wanted to share. Just wanted to give you that opportunity.
Yeah, nothing really comes to mind, but I always feel like when anytime we talk about mental health, I think it's really important to stress that if anytime anybody is ever feeling like they need help, you need to reach out for help. And there are resources out there, as the 988, I believe, to call. And from what I've heard from people who've called that it has saved their lives, because they are on the edge of doing something that they probably would have regretted, and that has saved their lives. And please always reach out. There are people that care. There are people in this field that actually do care. And I promise you that. I see it at the hospital. I promise you that I care about you. I promise, even though they may be strangers to you, a lot of these people in these fields, I promise, give a shit. They want to see you do better. That is not to say some people don't give a shit, because there are some people that suck. And only in this position for the wrong reasons, but that goes for every field. I believe most people that go into either social work or want to be a therapist or a psychiatrist, they genuinely want to help people. And please try and believe that and use that as much as you can to get healthy and happy and have the live the best life that you can, because you can. And I believe that. I've seen it.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Sometimes it helps with people when I ask this kind of question to think about like their younger selves and talking about to or talking to their younger selves. But do you have any advice or words of wisdom for people who are interested in pursuing the mental health field?
Yeah. Wherever you want to go, you know, there's lots of options. Social work is always a great place to start, just because it's so versatile, and, you know, and it's worldwide. There's a worldwide need for social workers, and it's becoming more and more of a in demand job, because people are starting to realize the value of social work and what social workers can do for people. I would ask you to kind of explore deep down why you want to do this, and what motivates you to do this. And I think, you know, and you can decide whether it's a genuine desire to help other people, or if it's, even if it's for the glory, you can still, you know, as glorious as social work is, I wouldn't say that, but I mean, there are, you know, psychiatrists, it's cool, right? That's a cool job. You know, you're prescribing meds, and it's just a kind of a cool kind of thing that people, you know, you see on TV, and, you know, they're just so sophisticated, Sigmund Freud and all those people. But even if you do that, make sure that it's because you have a desire to help, because there's going to be expectations there that are going to get crushed. And it's really hard to, you know, see you working so hard, and there are days where it feels like you're doing it for nothing, and that'll crush your spirit. And just realize you are making a difference if you ever get to that point. But yeah, if I could talk to my younger self, you know, everything just kind of played out naturally for me. So it's really hard. I just kind of always gravitated to helping people my entire life. I've always been generous, and always people knew they could call me and I would be there to pick them up, or I'd be there, hey, you know, I haven't eaten in a while or whatever. Hey, let's go get dinner. Or, you know, I was always helping people on the street. That was just my entire life since I can remember. So it was just something that kind of came naturally. But I would recommend, you know, social work's a good place to start. There's a lot of opportunity there, a lot of opportunity.
Well, Justin, I really appreciate you reaching out to come on the podcast, because this has been a fantastic conversation. I'm sure we will have some interviews on the perspective of patients, but I think your perspective is incredibly valuable. I love the energy that you bring to your work and your perspective. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And anytime, you know, you'd like me to come back and we'd chat about something else that comes to mind, by all means, reach out to me. You know, I've worked in the children's group homes for a long time, you know, and I have a lot of life experiences. I've worked overseas with children, and I've also been in the system as well, both on both ends. You know, I've worked at a prison. I've been on both sides of the fence, where I did time myself. And I've also been part of the mental health system as well. So I feel like I have a pretty good perspective on, you know, both sides of what it's like to not be listened to, and what it's like when people do listen. And I also know what it's like for people who are trying to listen, and sometimes they're just burnt out and can't. So anytime you want to have me back, I would love to come back and chat about this some more. So thank you.
That is a wrap for this month's episode of Talking Shit About. We'll be back in May with another interview, and before that, our last microsode in a couple of weeks. And it is sort of follows the same theme as this. It's going to be on crisis planning, so very relevant. Again, if you would like to support the show, you can follow me on all of the social, well, not all of the social medias, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook. You can subscribe to the show on your favorite podcasting platforms. I haven't done this in a while, so I'm a little rusty. Let's see. You can buy merch from my shop, and any proceeds from NIMBY Bingo or Abolish ICE Designs go to food banks in Tillamook County. And then you can also join my Patreon for $2 a month and get very sporadic mostly early access content, but also some behind the scenes and exclusives. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you soon.